Okay, welcome to this special edition of the McCovey Croncast. Joining me and Doug, that is Roger Munter. Roger from Minor Lines, the site, McCoveyChronicles.com. That's why you want to know what he has to say. Instead of waiting for his written post, you can get him verbally, orally, right now through your ears. He's going to tell us about the decimated, barren wasteland that is the Giants farm system. Roger, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the Giants
can't wait to talk about barren wastelands.
So the Giants are the Mad Max of farm systems. They're a sinkhole in which the Titanic fell into and the Hindenburg. It's like the end of the new Ghostbusters movie. It's just this portal of death and evil. Right?
But Mad Max was a good movie, so that must mean something good is there, right?
Well, everyone likes to look at horror and enjoy the fact that they're not a part of it. They like to watch it from a distance.
So they are not the Mad Max of the baseball world. That would be more like the Angels, probably. They're not one of the really, really, really terrible systems, but they are pretty thin, and they certainly went through some changes this year, for sure.
Yes, they went through changes worse than, say, puberty or something. It's like puberty during a divorce. So their body's changing and then things. So basically, mid-season, their top 10 prospect list, as Baseball America indicated, three of those players, including the number one player, are all gone from Major League Baseball. They no longer exist because the Giants had to get rid of them in order to lose in historic fashion in the playoffs.
That's right. That they did.
So,
well, they did, let's take into account it gives them a better chance to lose in historic fashion in the playoffs next year. So in that sense, it was really those trades were really successful.
So a quick
excellent point.
Yes, that Doug, you're always with the best perspective here. Let's do a quick rundown of the top 10 at the time. This is July 13th. Phil Bickford was number one, Tyler Beede number two, Christian Arroyo three, Chris Shaw four, Adalberto Mejia at five, Sam Coonrod at six, Andrew Suarez at seven, Lucius Fox at eight, nine, Joan Gregorio, and 10 is
I believe it's Joan.
Joan Gregorio. Juan was your bad self. Juan Gregorio? All right. Steven Dugar, number 10. That was the top 10 prospect list, and now it is just Jarrett Parker and a bag of pretzels.
And Jarrett Parker can't even be on the list because he's graduated.
That's right. So,
and you can pile on there, too, and note that Andrew Suzak was their number one prospect, was it the year before or 2 years ago, who was also included in those trades. So you can make them sound even worse if you would like to.
So we know
Matt Duffy was in one of those trades. So
yes,
fun.
That's right.
Who was an actual good player as opposed to a high prospect.
So yeah, so we know what the Brewers' plan was all along. Just wait to see who the number one picks in the Giants system were, and basically get them to give away their low leverage left-handed reliever. We can get into that in a minute, but you know, you look at the system. And I think everyone at the time, including all three of us, when we talked about it, you know, the Giants gave up a lot, but it wasn't in such a way that it was they've hobbled themselves forever. But how did the season essentially end for what they had? And were there any surprises for the people left on the list? And did anyone really open eyes to get on that list?
Well, I would say there are a few people who opened eyes, and one of the best things, so they traded away their midseason number one prospect in Bickford, but the second half was just huge success for Tyler Beede, who it's quite possible would have established himself as the number one prospect in the system even had they not made those trades, because his second half was a real success in almost every way. It could be. He had a small blip after the All-Star game where he had a couple bad starts, but then he just really plowed through August, and he ended up, I believe, second in the Eastern League in strikeouts by one or two strikeouts, which was a big thing because, of course, last year that's what everyone who knocked him for, that he wasn't missing bats. And he was also, I believe, the league leader in ERA. And he piled up innings. He showed the velocity he had in college on his four-seam. He was mixing four pitches really effectively, and he looked like a really, really good pitching prospect in AA by the end of the year. So I would say that's the number one takeaway for good things that happened the second half of the season. There were also some pretty big. Steve Duggar, who you noted was at the beginning of the year, I don't even know if he was on. I think he was in the prospect handbook, but way in the low 20s. And then his Cal League first half was tremendous. And his Eastern League second half was possibly even better, although he didn't show much power, but I don't think he's going to be a power guy. But he moved to center. He hit about 330 in AA in his first full season. He played a pretty decent center field. He's a guy who's always been kind of toolsy. Scouts get frustrated because he doesn't hit for power, even though he has power, and he doesn't steal bases, even though he has speed. But the things he does do are pretty impressive, which is play a decent center field, get on base, walk a lot, and make contact. So those were two big ones. We probably want to talk a little bit longer about Christian Arroyo because he may be there will be a lot of different interpretations as to what to make of his 2016, I would suspect.
Well, in terms of Duggar, I want to say that except for the walks, that sounds like the perfect Giants player. Has tools, doesn't use them, and doesn't have any power.
Yeah, he's an interesting fellow. I think he's the kind of guy that has always gotten a little bit of a rap from scouts because they want him to do more. But he may be one of those guys where if you kind of see him for what he is, he's productive. And if you want something that he isn't, you'll always be frustrated out of him. But he's certainly an interesting guy. And I guess the other thing about the second half is that they got some extremely productive pro-season debuts from several members of the draft class, particularly the top two outfielders, Brian Reynolds and Heath Quinn, were both tremendous. Heath Quinn actually was the Baseball America's short season ball player of the year. He was really good, and Reynolds, both of them ended up in San Jose in the San Jose playoffs, the Cal League playoffs, actually. They were both tremendous pro debuts, and I would say one of the interesting things, if people kind of don't know a lot about the Giants system, one of the interesting things that happened this year was outfield, which has always been a wasteland in their system, is maybe the deepest position they have in the system right now.
Get out of town. Log off right now. How dare you? That is offensive.
It's weird and unnerving.
Yeah. So speaking of outfielders, when do you think Austin Slater is going to be the World Series MVP? Like 2018, 2019? what are we looking at here?
Could we rock the world and have it be like 2019? It'd be an odd year. Austin Slater is an interesting character, isn't he? He had a tremendous 2016. He just hit everything and hit everything really, really hard. And then when he got to the PCL, he started hitting everything out of the stadium, although it remains to be seen whether that's PCL power or an actual manifestation of his ability to hit the ball hard. But
feels like it should just be that.
Yeah, I mean, he's always been contact-oriented, and he is a very much line drive hitter, and really his entire pro career has been a lot of loud contact. What that profile's at in the major leagues, I think it's still unclear because, you know, he's not a real standout defensive player anywhere, although he can do everything kind of okay. He's not a speed guy, he's not a power guy, but he's kind of a Giants-y guy. He's sort of the Matt Duffy of outfielders, maybe, but he makes a lot of loud contact is what he does, and he was making really loud contact in the PCL this year.
Well, that's a very un-Giants-y trait. Loud contact, so that would be encouraging if that was what he wound up doing if he graduated to the big leagues. I mean, we suffered through 3 months, Roger, of the sound of like pixie dust coming out of the packaging or just little taps.
Yes, we were not tearing up the ESPN hard contact leaderboards this year. No.
I'm pretty sure opening soda cans was louder contact than a lot of the Giants in the second half. So Brian Reynolds, I guess I want to kind of go back to in terms of did you get a chance to see him or did you hear anything like that kind of, I mean, he's an exciting guy, and I remember us talking about him, that the Giants were basically very fortunate to get him in that sense. Like, he projected to be a really good player, and so that's an encouraging start, I guess, if they're already kind of using him for their playoffs in this first half season.
Yeah, so he and Quinn, and actually another guy who was drafted a little lower down, Gio Brusa from UOP, all went to Salem Kaiser this year, and they all had very strong debuts. Reynolds got moved up to Augusta near the end of the year, and then to San Jose for just the playoffs. I saw a very little of him. Unfortunately, neither of the teams that he was on do a lot of televising and are far from me. But I caught a few glimpses of him. Scouts really, really like Brian Reynolds, and there's a lot of things to like about him. The only thing not to like about him, if you're a nervous type, is he tends to run up a lot of strikeouts. But he is hit everywhere he's been. He hit at Vanderbilt. He hit in TM USA international competitions. He hit well over 300 in his pro debut. He's a switch hitter. He hits for power from both sides, not eye-popping power, but he has a power bat from both sides. I guess the other thing, too, is if he falls short at some point in his development, it's going to be because it turned out he was a tweener, that he wasn't quite fast enough to be a true center fielder, and he wasn't quite powerful enough to be a corner outfielder. But, you know, for right now, he's a guy that turns a lot of scouting heads because he does a lot of things well. He's that profile.
The strikeouts, certainly interesting. He's in Augusta, 3-1 strikeout, 20 strikeouts, 3 walks. And then in the short season, Salem Kaiser was 40. He was 4-1 strikeouts. He had 41 strikeouts and 11 walks. So that's in 76 games, he struck out 61 times. So there's that.
Yeah.
Or 56 games, he struck out 61 times. So, you know, that's Brian's bad at math, but then Brian Reynolds is bad at contact sometimes. So there we go.
He struck out in college, too, but he's always hit for a high average, which is somewhat strange. You would think that the contact at some point is going to kill that. You know, bring it down somewhat. It hasn't yet. But like I say, he's always going to be a guy who gets by because he does lots of things well, I think, rather than anything great. So what that profile's at in the long run, we will wait and see.
So Slater and Beattie are both 23. And in fact, Slater's turning 24 before this year ends. And Beattie will cross over into that in May of 2017. So
yeah.
I guess I'm thinking, you know, those are two age ranges where it's maybe it's time to push a little bit, or maybe perhaps, and even Brian Reynolds is going to be turning 22,
right,
when the year starts. So I guess my thought is, is the Giants' organizational philosophy still going to be the same, or in terms of like just kind of let these things play out, or do you anticipate at least in one of those three guys some sort of let's push them a little bit and see if anything happens, or do you just think that they're not really wanting to do that?
I think that they have shown a distinct transition over the last 2-3 years to where they are pushing people. I mean, they've always been an organization that would, you know, the big guys, they would move them really fast. You know, obviously Bumgarner, Posey, those guys moved fast, but they were slow played a lot of guys. But the last couple of years, it seems to me, they have made aggressive promotions. Lots of people have reached AA in their first full season in the last 2 years. You know, Beattie did that. This year, Shaw, Duggar, and Hinojosa all did that. Last year, there were three that did that as well. They have been, and actually, Austin Slater is from the, is spent half a year in AAA, and this was only his second full season. Hunter Cole was another guy who moved all the way up to AA in his first full season. So they have been pushing people aggressively. And I know the farm director mentioned that, last winter, I remember hearing him say that they really changed their philosophy from don't push a guy too hard to don't get in a guy's way if he's moving. So I don't know if that's directly related to what's going on at the top or if it's just a change in the industry. But, you know, certainly with this is – and you talk about people's age this winter. Posey and Crawford both turned 30 before next spring training.
Yeah.
And I think Nunez does too. So they're going to take the field next opening day with more than half a starting lineup that's on the wrong side of 30. So injecting some youth into that lineup somewhere is definitely got to be a priority, I would think, for him at some point.
It's a crazy time where we're looking at a lot of these players hitting 30 suddenly, and you know, Buster Posey being a catcher, you have to start kind of grimacing every time he's out there, and he doesn't get he doesn't get a couple days off after a week or two. Now you're really feeling it.
And it's clearly a young man's game these days. I mean, the Cubs just beat Kershaw the other day, and five or six of their players were 24 and under.
Yeah. So I guess the big question is, then I guess we'll go to the Golden Goose, the big guy, Christian Arroyo. That's sort of the mystery person. He's probably the reason why Matt Duffy was ultimately considered to be expendable. And he's an interesting fella. He doesn't wear batting gloves either, I believe, which I'm not a fan of, even though I was proven completely wrong about the efficacy or the usefulness of that, the utility of that.
So we could definitely talk about what.
But
we
is he a nice? Do you, how much? Like, do you know? Is he a nice guy? Does he have a funny voice? Was he?
He is. I'll tell you one thing. He is, and I think this is part of. I really think this is part of why the Giants like him a lot. He's a very high energy kid. He sits on the rail and talks a lot. He's a chirper, and I think the Giants value that. I've always thought that with Hunter Pence, and they probably want somebody like that in the dugout when Pence starts transitioning out, the kind of guy who's go 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 and yap yap yap. And that's always been my impression of Arroyo, is that he's a high motor guy. So I don't know if that's nice or
I think it's great. I mean, it's it's baseball nice. I mean, I think a personality for the Giants is important, because Hunter Pence is going to miss 100 games every year, essentially. And so you're not going to have that motor in the clubhouse, and it'd be nice to have someone around who could.
Yeah, and a lot of their core guys have the laid back, calm persona. So it is good to have somebody like that, and you need to inject some energy. I mean,
right?
How much of this last season did they just look tired?
Yeah, the entire season, basically. Even when they were winning, it still looked like they were just like, "Oh, fine, I'll hit the ball." Jeez. So
yes.
All right. Well, that's good. I didn't have any sense of who he was, like, personality wise, his player persona, I guess you would say. But the talent is obviously the big thing. And this guy, I think we talked about this. You can see him playing third base. It's not out of the realm of possibility.
No, I thought he was actually. I saw him play third, I think, more than any other position in the games I watched this year. And I actually thought he looked really good there. He had good actions. He's always had good hands, and he has pretty good instincts. It was mostly his range that was a problem. He has a fine arm. So I could definitely see him at third.
I'm hearing Bill Miller here in this comp.
Well, except that if you look at Bill Miller's minor league numbers, his walk-to-K ratios were insane. I mean, he was like – he had like 2-1 seasons.
Well, Bill Miller was sort of always, at least initially, it was always sort of seemed like he was miscast as a third baseman, right? But he sort of played he played through that perception and proved people. I mean, it wasn't like people were saying he shouldn't be there, but just like, he's probably not the best, and he was fine.
Well, they said he doesn't have the power for the corner, probably.
Well,
and particularly in that era. And that's a question with Arroyo too. I mean, so on the good side. One, he was, the second youngest position player in the Eastern League this year. And he absolutely held his own. And he never really looked overmatched. He's over-aggressive somewhat. But But he was, I think, second in the league in doubles, which is good. He only hit three home runs. Not as good. so where the power kind of finds its level with him will be a question. And I think whether he can hone his approach, because he tends to be very swing first kind of player. So he doesn't walk that much either. And I mentioned this on Minor Lines a few times this year. If you look at his splits, when he was ahead in the count, he destroyed people. When he was behind in the count, he had almost no chance of getting on base. So finding a balance between his natural aggressiveness and his desire to hunt fastballs and having a bad approach is probably going to be the big tell on where his career goes, I think.
Yeah, but if someone like Javier Baez can sort of rein that in too, it's not impossible. I mean, Javier Baez got to the major leagues, and that was essentially what was his deal.
Absolutely.
I guess I'm not trying to make a one-to-one comparison here, but that seems like, you know, you've got these aggressive young hitters. That seems to be something that, you know, it's the risk-reward of all that.
Absolutely. And hit the ball you can hit. Do damage on the ball you can do damage is always a good approach to hitting. Right. And I think Arroyo is, in a way, it's funny how tight he is now to Matt Duffy. But I think, you know, a best case Christian Arroyo is going to be something like, you know, rookie year Matt Duffy. That's what we're looking for him to become. He doesn't have to be a huge power hitter. He has to be a really good defensive player who is also a really good contact player and can do some damage on the pitches he likes.
Would you expect for because Arroyo didn't have a ton of power this year, like you mentioned, three home runs, hit a lot of doubles, but three home runs. Would you expect a lot more of that power to come in the future as he fills out more? Because, you know, when he started the year, he was a 20-year-old in Richmond. And that's not, you know, he's not fully developed in any respect, and especially with regards to muscle. So would you expect some of those outs to become doubles and some of the doubles to become homers?
So I think in general with a young player, you expect that in the majors. You know, Francisco Lindor gets to the majors and suddenly hits home runs. And there are things that make it easier to hit home runs in the majors. You're facing harder stuff. The bats are harder. The balls are harder. His swing is not particularly geared to power. He tends to his swing hit off his front foot a little bit, and he doesn't have a lot of lift in his swing. But his doubles were not, like, by and large, ground balls past the third baseman. He stung balls off the wall a lot. So I kind of think yes, but I don't think, you know, we'll see a different power profile at the top. But if he's like a 10 to 12, if he turns into like Joe Panic, that would be a great outcome for him, I'd say.
Yeah, and I think AT&T Park helps right-handed power of any kind. And playing Colorado, if you were to play a full season, he'd get those Colorado games.
I don't think he's going to be a three-homer guy in the majors probably when he gets into his mid-20s.
Doug, do you have another question specifically about Christian Arroyo? Otherwise, I'm going to jump this route right here.
I do not, and I also don't appreciate the football metaphor.
I apologize, but it works here. I'm just kind of amped to ask it because the Giants gave away so much, well, traded away so much, and they basically made marginal incremental improvements. Which is fine. I mean, it's a tough market, free agency trading, etc. We all know that. Reasonable people understand that. But the big thing that they really needed, they were not able to get. And now, you know, if the trade was Joe Panic for Andrew Miller, which, maybe that was still the Yankees being like, you're going to do it? We're still not going to make that trade. We just wanted to screw with you. My question still is, could Christian Arroyo play second base?
I have like six answers for that question. I have to figure out which one I want. Christian Arroyo played a decent amount of second base, not nearly as much as third base this year. I think he's fine. I think he maybe would still run into a little bit of the range problem. But it's not the same as shortstop. I think he would be able to play second base. But I have to say the whole Joe Panic for Andrew Miller thing, what I've heard much more often from people, and in fact, I was just listening to the Alex Pavlovich's last podcast.
You can't mention the competition. I'm sorry. We're going to have to cut sorry this about short. That. Thanks, Roger.
No, 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 no. We need to live on this. We need actual information here.
Well, what he and Ray Rydell kept saying was that, in fact, the Yankees never made a demand of the Giants, that they more or less
just ignored
take the call.
Yeah.
Yeah, they wouldn't call him back, and the GM wouldn't get on the phone, and they just said, you don't have it. What we want, you don't have. And they didn't really even give the Giants a chance to overpay. And that's kind of an interesting prospect thing, too, because, you know, there's certainly a real-world outcome where Christian Arroyo is a better major league player than Gleyber Torres. You know, Gleyber Torres moves to second, the power doesn't come the way people think, blah, 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 and Arroyo is a great player. But there isn't a world in which Christian Arroyo is a better prospect asset than Gleyber Torres. And that is something that harms the Giants, because the players the Giants know that they can develop aren't always the same as the kind of profile that the industry values, which is much more athletic, kind of dynamic, Javi Baez sort of players. And the Giants don't tend to have a lot of those guys. And that hurts them when they try and go out on the trade market and get the big guys.
Or they trade him for Matt Moore.
Well, you know, Matt Duffy.
I was going with Fox. I was thinking Fox as more of the industry darling type that you're mentioning.
Yeah, yeah. And even he's probably not. They sort of traded low on Lucius Fox because he hadn't had a chance to really show off the dynamic athleticism yet. But he was one of those guys. He was the only thing they really had in the system that was like that kind of profile. I would agree with that. But yeah, I mean, it was obvious, I think, to the Giants. It was probably obvious to everybody that Andrew Miller would have made a difference on that team. They didn't have what the type of asset the industry values in that trade.
So then, I mean, I do want to talk about this now a little bit, because certainly since the season has ended, what's leaked out, or I guess has come out, is sort of the Giants viewed Will Smith as a low leverage reliever. And so it makes the trade all the more curious, I feel like.
I heard Buster only say that. That's the only place where I think I heard it. And you always wonder about national guys is how close they really are to them. But Buster only is a pretty legit baseball insider source. And he definitely said that on his podcast, that the day after, you know, this game, the day after the loss of the Cubs, he said that they went to Javi Lopez against Rizzo, which in my opinion was where that inning went off the rails, instead of Smith, because they thought Smith was a better low leverage guy than a high leverage guy. I don't know if they thought that before they traded, but they seemed, this coaching staff apparently, according to Buster Olney again, had gotten that feeling of him over the course of September. I don't know. I thought Smith looked great all of September, but
I think, I would agree. I would say he started off pretty rocky and like a completely unusable player. And then the last month of the season, he really sort of kicked it into gear. It still was a little curious that, you know, the Giants have two really interesting players from a stats observation viewpoint only, that they still don't indulge in any way, that being that they don't have, in the case of Will Smith, he sort of has that reverse platoon split, right?
Right.
And then Mack Williamson sort of, he's never really, he sort of has a reverse platoon split as well, or he hasn't really struggled against righties in his career either. And I just think it's interesting that the Giants, who we know are They used advanced statistics. They've been burned by the matchups and the defensive shifts. That I think that, you know, kind of ironically this year, that they, you know, that sort of viewed as an old school franchise, they're not. We know that, but they got burned by some new school stuff just by happenstance. Yeah. And then in the case of these reverse platoon splits, which I think is a useful thing to know, they didn't indulge that in any way. And Smith seems like, if you're going to give up that much to get in, that's sort of the extra value for him.
Yeah, and I certainly hope they use him that way next year. I mean, a lot of the second half of the season seemed to me to be revolving around Bochy not knowing who he could trust or not feeling trust for a lot of people on the team. At least that was my feeling watching the team. And that ninth inning, you know, he went to a guy who'd done it for him for many years, and he trusted. And probably that was a mistake.
The last time he'll ever play in the big leagues. Yeah. Well, okay,
hold on. So hold on. Which one?
I was thinking Lopez.
No, yeah. Me too. I was just making a fun joke about Sergio Romo, who I don't mention a lot, but has blocked me on Twitter.
Yeah, I think Romo might have done too. I could certainly see a scenario where Romo, Casilla, and Javier Lopez never pitch in the major leagues again. That doesn't seem unusual. I mean, I'm sure Romo and Casilla are going to get, if the Giants don't just bring Romo back, you know, I can certainly see them getting at least, you know, going to spring training. But, you know, Casilla's 36. He's going to be 37. He literally looked like he forgot how to play baseball, which is joking. I'm saying it jokingly, but, you know, we're also, you know, when you're 36, 37, you know, getting older is not a fun process. So,
that's true.
So, you know, your balance goes, things happen that are different, that are sort of out of your control. Who knows what's going on with him? I don't know. But he certainly didn't look like a Major League Baseball player from the end of the All-Star break on.
Yeah, I think that, I suspect Casilla does. But I wonder about Romo because he spent a lot of the year not playing. He was on the DL for a long time. And then when they finally got it back, he was pretty inconsistent with the slider. So, you know, he's thrown like a trillion sliders in his life. That takes a toll on you.
So I guess my big bow to put on all this is sort of, I will try to tie the major leagues into the minor leagues here. You know, you mentioned Bochy not knowing who to trust. And Doug, I'm just stealing this from you completely, but I'm going to credit you right now. Doug says that the part of that problem that you mentioned was that Bochy didn't take the time at any point in the season to let guys fail and essentially work through it. And I wonder if you know, watching minor league baseball all the time, I mean, that's a huge component of getting these guys ready. Do you think that that's going, like, is that going to have any bearing on the major league roster if they're going to enter the season with sort of the same type of bullpen, which is like, let's just cross our fingers and fix it on during the season?
I don't have an answer for you except to say that I think this is kind of the fascinating part of the offseason. I mean, so we're saying they're getting older. This is a team with an aging core that needs to get young. Do they make the choice to let Mack Williamson go out there and fail a little bit next year and be their left fielder? Or do they say, well, we've only got one more year of Johnny Cueto. Everyone's getting older. We need to take care of this year first and, you know, fork over the money for yet another 30-something-year-old bat to take over left field. I think certainly, personally, I would like the first thing. I would like to stick Mack out there and say, go through some growing pains. And I kind of agree. I mean, Doug's certainly got a good point. Maybe he let Josh Osage fail a good bit last year, more than I would have liked to see. But I mean, you have to let people fail a little bit. That's the hard part about being a prospect on a contending team. But the Dodgers were running all rookie lineups out there all September, and it didn't seem to hurt them that much.
Well, they have better prospects.
I mean, one of their prospects was working a checkout line for a grocery store last year.
And I mean, you're mentioning Mack, and I certainly, that's what I would prefer the Giants do. And certainly, it seems like between, you know, the increasing dissipation of Denard Span as an organism in this reality, you know, they're going to need... You know, there's going to be opportunities for backups to play a lot. The Giants got lucky sort of in May where they had all those injuries and they, whatever random ex-top prospects from other organizations they plugged in sort of worked out. And then all those guys got hurt so they couldn't bring them back later. But, you know, you know, I guess I was, my question was aimed more towards that bullpen, you know, Derek Law, or I guess in the case, we didn't even mention Ty Block, really, who really surprised. Yeah, yeah, you know, Jake Peavy's gone. Matt Cain is a non-factor. And so, you know, you've got these rotation spots. You've got some middle softiness in the bullpen. I don't see them bumping George Contos up to more of a, you know, more of that high leverage role. I'm not a believer in George Contos as the high leverage guy, but I mean, I certainly see his utility. And if he and Will Smith are sort of the low leverage quality arms, then there's your sixth inning, seventh inning, maybe. And then, you know, is Law really an answer towards the end of the game? He seems like a guy who should get the shot to you know, see if he can come back from the arm problems and be solid. But yeah. Everywhere else, I mean, Beattie's going to have to come up next this season is what I'm saying. And I'm like, they're just going to have to kind of Bumgarner and Lincecum through it, like when he struggles, see if he can pull it out.
Well, and they're also going to have to figure out the whole Okert-Osich thing. It's like, which one of these guys is ever going to be consistently trustworthy? I know Osich had off-season knee surgery, and that could certainly play a part in how terrible his control was last year. So we'll see if that
he's
helps.
He's really him. Following that Jeremy Affelt level.
Yes, I see it. You know, the thing about Derek Law, who I love to death, and he has great, great stuff. He was a guy like in high school. And the thing that has always been on his scouting report is that scouts don't trust that his body can hold up to the delivery, because it's a real high-impact delivery. And he's more or less lived up to that. He's had some DL stint in every year of his pro career. And he went away from starting almost immediately. He went to JC, and he was immediately a reliever. So I think the thing about Law is he's got – and there's not just DL stints, there's the kind of degradation of stuff that tends to be around DL stints. So the question with him is, will he hold up to a high leverage position for full seasons, for every season? He's a guy, to me, that I definitely want to be one of my best relievers, but I don't want him to be irreplaceable, because there's always a chance that he's going to be gone for a month, because it really is a high impact delivery.
So I'm okay,
but
Heath,
if you combine him and Ray Black, though, do you think you'll get a combined season out of them?
So Black basically is healthy for the 1 month that Law is not around.
Exactly. Yeah.
that might be the go-to plan. Yeah. But he certainly is a guy that you build part of the bullpen around. The back end bullpen solutions have to involve Law for sure.
Well, how about Gregorio converting him over, or making him a little more of a higher leveragey Contos? Although I guess they would just use Contos in that situation, but maybe something like that. Or does his stuff not really suggest a good bullpen role?
I'm a big fan of Gregorio as a reliever personally, and next year is actually his final option year, so he doesn't have a long time to figure out what role he is as a major leaguer if they keep him. But I think, you know, he's a big, big, big tall guy, and he gets massive downwards plane. So he's got a good hard sinker. He can throw in the mid 90s, and he's got a really good slider, which just seems kind of made to order for a seventh inning guy. I think I said this actually on Doug's, Joe Biagini column, the guy they have who could best become Joe Biagini is probably Johan Gregorio, because he's got the two pitches, the two hard pitches, everything goes down and away. You know, it just seems like a natural fit to me.
And starting or relieving versus starting, maybe that velocity goes up a little bit more? Because isn't he like a 92 guy?
He's always been a guy who wavered a lot, actually, and I think that's a little bit natural of really tall people, is that it takes them a while to kind of control their body, so their mechanics can waver, and when their mechanics waver, their stuff wavers. And that was Gregorio in his younger years. last year, not this, so in 2015, he both relieved and late in the season started in Richmond. And I didn't see that there was a big bump up in velocity in relief, but he's big enough now that he can be pretty consistently in like the 93 to 95 range anyway. I don't know. Doug, did you see him when he was in Sacramento this year?
I did. I was just looking to see if I ever tweeted out velocity, because my memory is that he would sit 94, 95, but that could be totally wrong. And so
that's my memory too. And that's my memory, relief and starting either one.
Yeah. So, I mean, I saw him almost, I think I saw him entirely as a starter, and he was doing a good job with that. He in Sacramento, he got a ton of strikeouts. He would just give up runs anyway. So there is a lot there. That seems like kind of a classic case of guy who needs some work, but clearly has a ton of talent and potential.
Yeah.
He's an inch taller than Ubaldo Jimenez, which, because you started talking about the mechanics, and he's very tall, obviously. I just started thinking about Ubaldo Jimenez, who looks like a mess. And that's what I thought of, because I've never watched Joan Gregorio pitch at all. I haven't even clicked on his video to see.
That's another kind of advantage of being a one-inning guy as opposed to a starter, too.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
I don't know, to me, that makes a lot of sense. So we'll see if that's where they go with him.
So the average fan, average Jane or Jim fan of the Giants, who maybe are local to Sacramento and want to go watch, they're still the Rivercats, right?
Yes.
Or there's something else.
Yes.
Okay, still the Rivercats, yeah.
Go watch the Rivercats, at least.
Or they want to go to San Jose and watch some baby Giants. Or I guess two final questions for me, and that is, what is the what's the bang for your buck if you're wanting to watch them? And then sort of as a fan who doesn't want to watch them but wants to feel one way or the other about the Giants, what's the basically the one word or the one line description for the Giants farm system as they head into 2017? So two questions are probably pretty meaty.
I've already forgotten the first question at this point.
The first question is, who's the bang for the buck in Sacramento or San Jose? Who do you have to see if I'm coming to you and I'm like, Roger, I'm going to go see a minor league game. Where should I go? I go to Sacramento or San Jose?
So I have to tangent for a second, and then I will answer that question.
Largely tangential podcast. It works out.
When you talk about the farm system, of course, everyone loves to talk about prospects and homegrown players and blah, 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 blah. But one thing that's certainly a big story of the Giants 2016 and frequently is all of those random guys from other systems that you were talking about who started the year in Sacramento's lineup and ended up helping them get as far as they did. I mean, Sacramento on opening day was Ramon Pena and Grant Green and, of course, Connor Gillespie and Albert Suarez and Gorkys Hernandez. Some of those guys were here for 2 weeks and helped and are gone, and some will probably be part of the 2017 Giants. And the Giants do that really, really well, and that's a part of the farm system that is really important that we tend to skimp over a lot. So I just thought I'd take a second to note that they did a really good job finding those guys this year.
All right, well, that's kind of like a preview. See what they do in the offseason picking those guys up.
So 2017 Sacramento is probably going to be full of a whole bunch more of those guys, would be my guess. but the bang for your buck to me will be San Jose, because I would expect Brian Reynolds and Heath Quinn to be two-thirds of their starting outfield, and you definitely want to go see those guys. That's probably the biggest bang of those two teams. Sacramento, who's going to be in Sacramento? Well, Christian Royal might be in Sacramento, and that's some pretty good bang for your buck, too. And Tyler Beattie should be in Sacramento. So you probably have the one and two prospects headlining that team. And those guys are going to be in San Francisco soon, so that's definitely something to see.
That's great.
Now I've forgotten the second question.
That's great. Now you do. So the second question is sort of what's the either one word or one line description for if you were just to give one of those like ESPN either power rankings or one line description of the Giants farm system as we head into 2017.
It's thin. It doesn't have elite guys, but it has a lot of potential contributors, including very close to ready potential contributors.
So it's Freddy Sanchez.
It could be Freddy Sanchez. It could be.
If the Giants had an organization of nothing but Freddy Sanchez's, they would be so happy.
Yes, absolutely. Well, who wouldn't? All organizations want a bunch of Freddy Sanchez's around. I'm also going to go ahead and say that I'm a pretty big believer in Heath Quinn. I think he could be. If there's a guy who is like impact, it may be him. Other than Chris Shaw, who's like obviously the best power hitter they have, and we forgot to mention anything about.
Yeah, we did.
I'm a pretty big Heath Quinn believer.
Well, what's Chris Shaw's sort of big deal? I mean, 2 seconds on him, I think we can take, since we didn't talk about him at all.
Chris Shaw, who now is their highest picked player from the 2015 draft, now that Pickford is gone, real serious left-handed power, and a little better feel for hit than people tend to think. He's not going to have high averages, but he draws walks, so he'll probably be a 250 guy. Hits left-handers kind of decently okay, but real power. The Shaw thing is, of course, that he gets really tied into Brandon Belt because he can't really play anywhere but first base. So,
yeah, I'm looking at his pictures right now. Just body-wise, I'm like, well, I guess you can plant him at first or – like cart him behind the plate, but
he's going to be about his power bat. That's the value he brings, and it's a real value. The question will be how the organization figures out how to utilize it.
Well, they were fine with throwing Michael Morris out in the left field for an entire season, and it more or less worked out. he's going to be 20. He just turned 23. So Shaw's another guy, so who's probably going next year is going to be a really big deal for him.
Half a year in Double A this year. He had a huge, huge year in San Jose where he was really getting the kind of intentional walk treatment at the end of his time there, and they also had a huge shift that they were putting on him all the time. He had a blip when he went up to Double A, and he was getting abused a little bit, but he came back with a really solid August. So, given that he's had only one professional year or one full year to be, you know, 2-3 months into a Double A career, he's doing pretty well. But yeah, he is going to be a guy who I think they're going to want to push if they can figure out how to make the playing time work out.
All right, Doug, any last thoughts or multi-part questions to tie?
Yeah,
Roger?
I have. So one guy who had a very strange up and down, more down than up, but still with flashes here, was Kyle Crick. And what do you see happening with him?
Yikes.
Because this year, it was better than last year, it seemed like. He did actually have stretches of competence.
And, you know, what was interesting watching him, so when they put him in the bullpen last year, that was a real kind of fiasco, in part because he's worse out of the stretch than he is out of the windup.
Good grief.
So they put him back in the rotation this year, and he did have really nice looking starts. What was kind of interesting was he wasn't throwing at the same velocity he has in the past. And I think this seems to be a Giants thing the last few years of, I think they were having him go to a two seam fastball a lot more than a four seamer. Because his velocity was consistently down like 93, 94 instead of like 96, 97 where he tends to live. But he did have better control. His year was up and down. I've heard that the Giants liked his year. He was able to kind of go out and mostly not have disaster starts, but it is really hard to figure out what to make of Kyle Crick at this point. He really has had the same kind of mechanical problems since he was in A-ball that he hasn't ever been able to fix, which is consistent landing point and having his front fly open. He just has trouble repeating his motion, and he also goes through long phases where he seems to forget that he has secondaries, and that he really focused on this year, and I think that's the best thing you can take from his 2016 is they were making him throw his breaking pitch and his changeup in all counts and really utilize it, where the year before he frequently looked like he forgot he had them.
That's kind of crazy when you consider that. I know pitchers basically call their own games at every level, but still, it seems kind of crazy that that doesn't get stopped after like two starts max, and the manager's just like, if you want to play, you're going to do this.
You're going to do this. It's a very weird history with him, because I know when he was in San Jose, Joe Rizzo was saying that his changeup was his best pitch by the end of that year. And I was really excited to see him. He showed up in Richmond the next spring, and he had no faith in the pitch at all. So I don't know. Pitching is a strange. There's something strange about having confidence in your pitches. But he did better on that this year. He did better throwing his breaking pitch. And I don't really know what to make of Kyle Crick. I thought his breaking ball was better when he was, 19 years old in Augusta than it was at times that I've seen him in Richmond. But he's still got a really big arm and a body that can absorb innings. So you just kind of hope something clicks at some point in time. It is hard to have faith that that is going to happen. But there's, people say they should really drop him from the 40-man. You hear people say, why are they keeping Crick on the 40-man? I can tell you there would be 29 orgs that would pick him up in a hurry if they did that.
Not the Yankees.
Well, they wouldn't trade Andrew Miller for sure.
Well, also there's just that weird thing in baseball, like, who knows what wasteland, July of 2017 is going to be for the Giants again. Maybe they're fine, maybe they're not, but, they have to foist him into action, essentially. Yeah. How many times have we seen in baseball through any other teams, not just the Giants, where some prospect who is bad in the minors and they just have to sort of emergency start him, he comes up and he's fine. And it's almost like putting him in the minors was somehow detrimental to him in his development. I'm not saying that's going to be the case here, but it just seems like, you're mentioning his very strong positives. Who knows? Maybe he's the guy. Albert Suarez was fine in the major leagues, and he was solid in the minors, right? And he just, or is this going to be Ryan Jensen? But even Ryan Jensen had his serviceable moments, but was sort of there out of necessity.
Well, I guess so. It's like if you're trying to fix the left-handed and the bullpen situation, who do you really want there? Do you want Josh Osich trying to figure out how to throw with command, or do you want Ty Block living on the corner?
Yeah.
And that's kind of it with Kyle Crick. Kyle Crick, if he could ever figure out mechanical things that prevent him from throwing strikes, is a obvious utilizable major league arm. Whereas other guys, Clayton Blackburn, for instance, is a guy who kind of knows what he's doing, but has very little margin for error. And when the stuff degrades, as it does through the course of the year, it's probably going to get hit hard. So
he gets Clayton Blackburned.
They've always been tied together because they were, they were in the same draft class together, and they're just completely flipped sides of a coin, I guess. Doug, Roger, I completely avoided answering your question, which is to say I have no idea what to say about Kyle Crick.
I just wanted the listeners out there to know nobody knows. You might be like, what's going on with Kyle Crick? And the reason no one talks about it is, imagine a person shrugging right now.
Yeah. Well, and this is good that it comes. It's good that this comes on the heels of, I think, two times ago that you were on, where we talked about, what's this perception about the Giants being miracle workers and fixing pitchers? And you're like, they're fine. There's nothing special about them, because certainly if you throw this Crick issue, I'm sure this was talked about. Well, if anyone can fix Kyle Crick, it's the Giants. And it's everything you said has sort of been like, he's got to figure out how to land, repeat his delivery and find his command and all that. The Giants can only do so much. If he's not going to throw his secondary pitches, they can't stand behind him and, throw his arm or, reconfigure his fingers on the ball. He's got to want to do it.
Yeah, I felt bad. I remember that time, and I kind of felt bad when I got to the end of that answer like I had made them sound more negative than I meant to. All I really meant to say is, in the end, it's up to the pitcher to figure it out. They can do all the help they want. And on the positive side, too, did they pitcher whisper Tyler Beattie? Or, you know, they helped him find his way, but he's put in the work, and he's the one out there growing. So the credit goes to the pitcher.
Oh, sure. Yeah. All right. Well, Roger, thank you so much for joining us this whole season. It's been great. And we appreciate your insights on the site and for making, you know, bringing some actual information to the podcast.
I hope so. It's fun being here though.
All right. So we can still find you on Minor Lines on the site, and people can find you on Twitter at Rog, ROG61, right?
That is me. Probably not so much Minor Linesing through the winter, but I will definitely be back when spring training comes. So.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to all take a long winter from this tire fire of a season.
And then we'll come back with some odd year success.
Dear success. I like how boring that sounds. Even your bullshit, odd year success. That's definitely what the slogan should be.
All right, thanks, guys. Roger. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.